You're listening to the Warrior Priest Podcast.
And this is the Warrior Priest Podcast, midweek debrief number 187. And I am the Warrior Priest, Donovan Riley. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Thank you, as always, for your time and your attention today. I truly appreciate it. It is a good day, a glorious day. We have reached over 1,000 followers now on Spotify, 1,000 subscribers. So thank you to everyone who listens on Spotify. That is amazing. I think we're now close to 10,000 listeners altogether on Spotify for the podcast. So to all of you who listen, thank you. To all of you who don't subscribe, why don't you subscribe? Hit the button, baby. It's good for you. It's full of vitamin C and electrolytes. But today, since I am mostly out of my mind from all the translation work that I've been doing the past 3 weeks plus, I truly do feel like I'm walking on the liminal edge at this point. All I do is translate and think about God's word and about ancient texts. So that's what I do most days. Read ancient texts, translate ancient texts, think about ancient texts, and then show up once in a while to teach them and preach on them. And in between, I try to rattle my brain loose by getting it kicked or punched or elbowed or kneed or just strangled for a little bit. And I think to begin then, something that I thought about when I woke up this morning, because it's the first time that I've ever died in my dreams. Last night I died in my dreams. I still remember it. It was extremely vivid. I drank poison. It was wine that was poisoned. And I was with someone else. I don't remember who or why, but I died. I remember that. It was a fast-acting poison. And then I woke up, and I wasn't dead in my dream. And everyone around me had mourned my death. So everyone was shocked to see me alive, overjoyed that I was alive. And yet I could not explain to them what had happened, other than to say, I drank poison, I died, and now I'm alive. So then I said, maybe we're all dead, and maybe you don't know it. So then I ran around checking the clocks and checking outside, looking around to see if we were all dead, if we were all in heaven or in limbo or somewhere other than the real world, or at least this earthly realm. But we were on earth, and I died and came back. And then some other things happened, and I woke up. And like I said, this has been a profound experience. This has never happened to me before. In the past, if I've been dreaming lucidly, and I was falling or shot at or attacked or was in a car accident, any number of scenarios where I was going to die, I would always wake up. But this time I didn't. And it got me thinking about the question of, what is a dream? Why do we dream? Psychologists, psychoanalysts, experts can explain to us the mechanisms of dreaming, what happens within the brain, what happens to brain chemistry to induce REM sleep and lucid dreaming states, but it cannot explain why. It can posit theories, and there are plenty of those, but no one has ever been able to explain where dreams come from and why we dream. Not shaman, not priests, not oracles, no one. In the pre-modern world, dreaming was seen as a form of communication between men and the gods. Or the oracles received dreams or visions in the Bible. There are many, many instances of people being shown visions in a dream, such as Abraham, for example, or Jacob, some of the prophets, like Ezekiel, many people dream and receive visions from God. But yet, outside of that pre-modern understanding of the dream state as the place where God communicates with us, we don't really know why we dream, which is fascinating to me, I think, that we claim to know so much about so many things, and yet we don't understand what happens inside of us. So I've been ruminating on that today, and it leads me to today's episode, which is the question of time. One of the reasons that I record this podcast is when I think about my life, as we all do, especially as we get older, and the time behind us increases, whereas the time in front of us decreases. When I think too much about time, it depresses me and fills me with a sense of dread that I am running out of time. This is not something that hit me later in life. I have been concerned about time since I was a little boy. When I was 7 or 8, people would complain that I was too obsessed with death and too preoccupied with questions about where we come from, where we are going, what the purpose of life is, and all those types of things. So time for me, even as an adolescent, was something that I wrestled with and caused me concern. Because when you're a boy, you can't wait to grow up, to become big and strong and independent and free. Then you grow up and you learn about the world. You experience life, that you are not so independent, that it's not such a great thing to be on your own, that you are not as free as you imagined you could be or ever will be, and that being an adult, a lot of the time, isn't any fun. In fact, as I said to a friend last night, one of my favorite quotes by C.S. Lewis is in a letter he wrote to a girl, I think in her teens at the time, and he said, "I hope someday you are old enough to enjoy fairy tales again," because he was lamenting that she was going off to college eventually and that she would no longer take any interest in the stories that he was writing. But he knew something that I am now learning, which is that at a certain point in life, when you mature, when you have been seasoned, you look over your shoulder wistfully at the past and you wonder, when did I lose my excitement at living? When did I stop dreaming? When did I stop hoping? Somewhere along the line, when you become an adult, it just evaporates. Sometimes, maybe most of the time, without us ever being aware that it's occurring. But for some of us then, we're also startled awake, and we realize that we have been robbed of our treasures, whether it be by the devil or a dragon, or simply other really boring adults. So what do we do? For myself, as has been explicitly obvious, it has been to go back to my first loves, to my first marriages when it comes to writers and stories. To recognize now as I'm older, and as I was thinking about this morning, when I was young, I wanted to be a race car driver, just to use an example, an analogy. I wanted to be Spider-Man when I was young, but for the sake of my example, race car driver. And what I mean is, when I was young, I wanted to drive fast, and I could not wait to grow up and get my license so that I could drive around in a hot rod, just like the Dukes of Hazzard or Knight Rider. Cannonball Run, great movie. And then I grew up and I got my license, and that is exactly what I did. I drove around recklessly. I raced around the streets and back roads of the town that I grew up in. I trashed two cars between the ages of 16 and 23. And as I got older, I stopped driving quite as fast and definitely stopped driving as recklessly. But also, as I got older, it wasn't driving fast that entertained my imagination. It was, how does this car work? I want to understand how the engine operates, and I want to understand the chassis and the axle. I want to understand the makeup of this car and what makes it go. It's not enough to just drive fast. I want to know why the car can go fast. And that's where I'm at with authors nowadays and with texts. When I was younger, I just wanted to read them and read through them as fast as possible because there's another book on the shelf just waiting for me to give it my attention. Read a book, set it aside. Read a book, set it aside. Read a book, set it aside. And that is certainly one way to go about doing it, and I highly recommend it to young people. Read as much as possible. Read everything. Read in every genre. Fill your head full of ideas and words and thoughts and places and people. But as you get older, and you are full, then it's time to sit down and digest everything that you have eaten. Ask yourself, is it enough to just eat the food? What is the food made from? What are the ingredients? How was this prepared? Why did it taste the way that it did? Why do I like this more than that? And so when I read Tolkien or Chesterton on fairy tales, or I read Lewis on image and symbol, this is what I'm doing now, is asking them the question, all right, I've read your books, and I liked them, I enjoyed them, I loved them. But now that I've pulled them out again, tell me your process. Tell me your inspirations. Tell me how you wrote these words and created these characters. Teach me. Because I want to understand the world more broadly and more deeply. I don't want to wrestle with texts anymore, as I said to a friend yesterday. When I was younger, and I read the Bible, for example, I would open it in order to wrestle with God. And what I was wrestling with him over was, I have to teach this Sunday. Give me what I'm supposed to teach. Give me the lesson. I have to preach on Sunday. Give me the sermon. And I would wrestle with God for something. I was young, I was inexperienced, I was desperate to show up with something great, because good enough isn't good enough for me, of course. But in time, that tarnished, and I was worn down by the exercise of constantly wrestling with God. Whereas now, I play, and I go on adventures when I translate, and I play within the boundaries of Scripture, and Tolkien, and Chesterton, and Beowulf. I play, and I go on adventures, because I am now old enough to enjoy fairy tales again. I am old enough to go on adventures again, because I have gone back and recovered those treasures. And in order to do so, you have to go on an adventure, and you have to have a childlike sense of wonder and amazement at the world, because those authors did as well. You have to go back and you have to accept their rules. When you go into ancient texts that are 2,000 or 6,000 years old, you have to ask the author, how do you see the world? And then how do you describe it? What language do you use to describe the world that you inhabit? Tell me about the God you worship. Tell me about how you relate to other men and women who live around you in your tribe or your village. Teach me to see the world the way that you saw it once. And in doing so, you recover what has been lost. which is a worldview, a cosmology that is so profound, so deep and broad that to call those people primitive is an insult. It's laughable. It's so naive or possibly ignorant in the case of so many academics that the so-called primitive ancients had a much broader view of reality and engaged with reality in a much more profound and deeper way than we do today. I would even argue, as I said previously, that now that we are entering into a new Dark Ages, we hardly ever seek to engage with reality. We stay to ourselves, we keep our heads down, we keep our eyes on our screens, and we avoid the confrontation with life, the universe, and everything. And we're satisfied with that. And yet, because of that, we wither because we are not being fed. We are not being nurtured and sustained by truth and by meaning. And this is, I think, what has led so many people to become hopeless and wander through life and treat everything as an accident and see themselves as a victim with no agency, nothing to participate in that is greater than themselves. And so, for me anyways, time is at the root of all of this because it's inescapable. No matter what you want to say about your truth versus my truth or objective versus subjective truth, there is one objective truth that none of us can avoid, and that is time. Time is relative. It speeds up and slows down depending on our focus and our attention on it, but it is inevitable. And so for myself, one of the reasons I record this podcast or record my sermons or stream Bible studies on Sunday mornings or write articles and books is because selfishly and probably pitifully, I think about time and I think about my individual life and how small, minuscule it is, how unimportant it is in the grand narrative of history. And it fills me with dread, like I said. And so I speak and write in order, well, like the old pagans, to leave a legacy, something that is proof that I was here. And the more I focus on time, the more I focus on what can I leave behind? What relic? What statue? What memory of myself can I leave behind as an anchor that proves that I was here? And I wonder, and I've never really had this conversation with people that have 1, 2, 3 million podcast subscribers or have millions of followers in whatever arena they are a part of. But I wouldn't doubt, knowing human psychology and the heart the way that I do, they probably suffer from the same thing, that they only have 3 million followers. Only 10 million people have bought their record. Only 50 million people watched their movie, whatever it may be. There's always that hunger for more, to leave a bigger imprint. This is what drives power mongers to destroy civilizations in the pursuit of immortality. And I think it is an enormous waste of time and energy. And yet we all do it. We can't help ourselves. Because as I said, no matter what we may want to say about the truth or about reality, time is undeniable. And so one of the reasons that I do what I do, and possibly you can relate to this and sympathize, is that I humor myself and try to convince myself that if I can affect even a handful of people for the better, then I've left the world a better place if today is my death day. But that's a pious platitude. Is it true? Yes, absolutely. It is my conviction to leave this world a better place than I entered it, or when I entered it. That is true. But that is downstream from dread and fear about the future and about time. And I think if we were all just a little bit more honest about our dread of time, our fear, and the sense of anxiety that overshadows us when we think about how much time we might possibly have left on this planet, perhaps then we would take more seriously the times when we can play, when we can go on adventures, when we can recover that childlike sense of wonder and curiosity about the world. And instead of using the time allotted to us to scroll, for example, or to simply sit in front of the TV and let it make us numb, we'd read a good book. We'd have a drink with friends. We'd share a joke and a laugh. We'd sing a song. We'd go on a hike. We'd build a fire. We'd tell a story. We'd participate more fully and robustly in reality. And then in those moments, time would lengthen and it would slip from our grasp. And we would realize, we would recognize that the less we focus on time, the longer our life becomes. And if we devote ourselves to those things which cause us to become unconscious to our grip on time, so that we don't care that we've let it slip out of our hands, then that vacation isn't just for 12 days, it's for months. And that moment when we first held hands ceases to be a moment and becomes eternity. And that love that we had when we were children, that pure, naive love for people and things and places, never left us. It just went dormant, and it is waking up now. All we have to do is give it a little rub on the shoulder. I think it's time that we did that. I think it's time that we woke ourselves up to reality, so that we could all let time slip away and participate in eternity for a while. So with that being said, I'm going to read to you again this week from my translation of Exodus chapter 14, and then share my ruminations, my homily on the next step, the next story in this ongoing series that I am doing on Wednesday evenings for Lent, telling this mythic tale that begins at the creation of everything and stretches out into the resurrection to eternal life. So again, thank you for listening. Thank you for being a part of what I'm doing on this podcast. And thank you for the encouragement and all that you do to let me know that this matters. And so that being said, this is from the book of Moses, the book of Exodus, chapter 14. The Lord spoke to Moses and said, "Speak to the sons of Israel that they turn back and set up their tents before Pi Hahiroth, which is between Migdol and the sea, before Baal Zephon. In their sight, you will set up tents overlooking the sea." Then Pharaoh will say, about the sons of Israel, they have become entangled by the land, and the wilderness has closed round them. And I will make his heart hard, and he will pursue you, and I will be glorified in Pharaoh and in all his army. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. And they did so. And it was told to the king of Egypt that the people had fled, so that the heart of Pharaoh and of his servants was changed toward the people. And they said, "What have we done, that we sent away Israel, so that they should not serve us?" Therefore Pharaoh harnessed his chariot, and took with him all his soldiers. And he took 600 chosen chariots, and all the chariots that were in Egypt, and the captains of all the army. And the Lord made hard the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the sons of Israel, because they had gone out with a defiant high hand. And when the Egyptians pursued the sons of Israel, they found them in tents by the sea, all the riders and chariots of Pharaoh, and all of the army that were with him, at Pi-Hahiroth, before Baal-Zephon. Then, when Pharaoh came near to the sons of Israel, they lifted their eyes, and they saw the Egyptians behind them. And they were filled with a great fear, and they cried to the Lord. And they said to Moses, "Perhaps there were not enough graves in Egypt, so you have taken us away to die in the wilderness. Why would you do this, leading us out of Egypt? Are these not the words which we spoke to you in Egypt, and said to you, 'Go away, so that we may serve the Egyptians'? It is much better to serve them than to die in the wilderness." And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the great works of God, which he will do today for you. You will never see the Egyptians again. The Lord will fight for you, and you will be silent." And the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Speak to the sons of Israel, so that they go out, and raise your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea, and divide it, so that the sons of Israel may go into the middle of the sea upon dry ground. On the other hand, I will harden the heart of the Egyptians, so that they may pursue you, and I will be glorified in Pharaoh and in all his army, and in his chariots and in his soldiers. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord God, when I am glorified in Pharaoh, and in his chariots, and in his soldiers." Then the angel of the Lord, who went before the camps of Israel, went behind them, and the pillar of cloud went with him, and stood between the camps of the Egyptians and the camps of Israel. And the cloud was dark towards the Egyptians, but lightening the night towards the children of Israel, so that during the whole night they might not come near to each other. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord took it away, while a great and burning wind blew all through the night, and turned it into dry ground, and the water was divided. And the sons of Israel entered into the midst of the dry sea, and the water was like a wall on the right and the left side of them. And the Egyptians pursued and entered in after them, all the riders of Pharaoh, his chariots, and soldiers. They went into the midst of the sea. And at the waking of the morning, the Lord looked upon the camps of the Egyptians in a pillar of fire and cloud, and killed the army, and destroyed the wheels of their chariots, and they were dragged into the depths. Therefore, the Egyptians said, "Let us flee, Israel, because the Lord fights for them against us." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Hold out your hand over the sea, so that the waters may turn again towards the Egyptians, towards their chariots and soldiers." And when Moses held out his hand over the sea, it returned again in the morning to its former place, so that when the Egyptians fled, the waters came again, and the Lord wrapped them in the floods. And the waters returned again and covered the chariots and soldiers of all the army of Pharaoh who followed him, and who had entered into the sea, and not one of them was left alive. But the sons of Israel went through the midst of the dry sea, and the waters were like a wall on the right and left side of them. In that day the Lord delivered Israel from the hand of the Egyptians, and they saw the Egyptians dead on the shore of the sea. And they saw the great hand which the Lord had used against them. And the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in Moses, his servant. And again, that is the book of Moses, the book of Exodus, chapter 14. And now to the homily. To comprehend the meaning of Lent, we must look long at the flames of Ur. Her stone walls were sacked. The Shemashki Elamites ruled the place for a while, but what could they do? Other tribes were rising, flexing their strength, ruddy with youth and untapped by famine. These were the Larsa, Lagash, and finally, Babylon. Ashur, too, was massing in the north. Puzur Ashur the First did this. But he was no king. He was only Ishiach Ashur, viceroy of God. He gathered much power and sowed many seeds of terror that would grow into an Assyrian empire. Far away, over the desert, Egypt fell and rose. The old kingdom was gone before Abraham was born. Then came a short dark age when Abram wandered the land. Mentuhotep II came afterward, unifying the Egyptians. But Mentuhotep II and his successors are all dead. And after them, Semites from Canaan, Philistia, and others from the regions of the Levant were given authority over Egypt's affairs. These were the Hyksos, among whom was Jacob's son, Joseph. Jacob, the son of Isaac, the son of Abraham. He was the second of two sons, a heel striker, a deceiver, like the serpent. And though he attained his blessing by treachery, God remained true to his promise to Abraham. Jacob was protected. He saw a tower ascending into the heavens, revealing that heaven and earth had not been fully sundered. Emissaries came and went from the tower at God's command. Later, much later, that tower would be a man. Then Jacob wrestled with God, It was not the peace of a marriage embrace, nor the union of bride and groom portrayed in the garden, but a vestige of Adam remained. Jacob was blessed and renamed Israel. He married sisters and had many sons: Reuben, Simeon, Levi and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Gad, Asher, Dan, Naphtali, Joseph, and Benjamin. Of these, Joseph was unique. The Spirit of God was upon him. Though he was betrayed and lived on as a slave, he rose to outstanding power. He was truly a king, full of the Spirit, ruling a nation. In Egypt, he did this, almost as if God had planned to bless the world, even his opponents, through these, his mortal instruments. God brought Joseph's family to Egypt, and it was there that the promise survived. It survived, but barely. The Semites declined, and a new kingdom arose, ruled over by the greatest of all her pharaohs, who was feared everywhere. And while the Egyptians grew, the Hebrews withered. Hated was the sound of their alien tongues. Hated were these outlanders. The favors Joseph and his people did for Egypt were long since forgotten. Eventually, they were enslaved. And so began one of the long, nightmaric ages when God, it seems, is silent. No word was sent. No deliverance came. Who could blame the Hebrews for thinking he'd gone? 400 years with no answer. 400 years. And then everything changed. Yahweh was headed to Egypt, it turned out. He was on his way there to confront all humanity's problem: spiritual oppression, sin, and death. A man called Moses, highly esteemed in both practical wisdom and courage, spoken of in the same breath as Sumerian kings, Egyptian founders, and the world's original emperors, was sent home, summoned into the presence of Pharaoh to speak and act on behalf of God, to stamp history forever. He came to establish the pattern of salvation, the unmaking of creation, the Passover, and the sea of death with its foul guardian. And so it was that God kept his promise to Abraham by the hand of Moses. "I am Yahweh," he said. "I brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and you will have no other gods before me." The people were terrified. They turned, stumbled, and ran. Some fell on their faces. Some blocked their ears. All trembled, though it was not a frightening voice. It was a voice like the sea, like the roar of the gulf when the wind had churned up the waters. It was swift as a creek on a mountain and cool as a well in the shade. The voice that had been there in the beginning was speaking again. The voice was beauty, but a terrible beauty that terrified Israel. Here at last was the righteous one. Who could abide the day of his coming? Not many. And yet, even so, Yahweh delivered his 10 words, his 10 commandments, in his own voice, to a people who did not want to hear it. "Please," they begged, don't have God speak to us. They pointed to Moses. You speak to us, lest we die. So Moses climbed the mountain again, going into the thick darkness where God was, and there received the law. The law was a vassal treaty, which introduced the king to his new people. It was also a marriage covenant, which called Israel, the ever unfaithful bride, into an unbreakable union with Yahweh, a covenant sealed by a sacrifice and followed by a feast. After that, months, years, and decades passed. A generation asked to remain in the wilderness, and they were allowed to. Israel wandered and rebelled and perished and hoped. In the end, Moses himself was ready to go. He blessed his successor, Joshua, spoke his last words, and walked out of the camp. And with Yahweh, he climbed to the top of a mountain and died. After his death, the people waited for a prophet like Moses to appear, because Moses had told them to watch. Yahweh, your God, will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers, Moses had said. To him you will listen. And so, the invitation is in front of you too, to hear him. Come, Jesus says, and follow me. Come and learn how to live. Come with me, and I will heal your heart. Follow me, and I will make you human again. Many before you have accepted the invitation. There is Paul, the persecutor, who saw Jesus on the throne of God and was blinded by the revelation. There is Polycarp, whose blood put out the fire. There is Irenaeus, who stood like a lighthouse on the edge of a stormy sea, and the waves were perversions of the gospel of Jesus. And yet, he did not yield. There is George, the red-crossed knight, who offered up his head to an emperor rather than renounce his faith. There is Ephraim, the Syrian, John, the golden mouth, and the venerable Bede. You may not know their names, but they are your ancestors. They are your family. They have passed the good news of Jesus from door to door, from generation to generation, like small buckets of sacred treasure. And now, at last, it comes to you. And it is time for your hearts to expand with the inexhaustible joy of God's love. The love of him who leads you through the sea of death onto the welcoming shores of paradise. And that is the end of the homily. So, once again, thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your encouragement and help. I hope that this is beneficial to you. I hope that it gives you comfort, that it gives you hope, that it inspires you to go tell your stories and to rekindle your excitement for books that maybe gathering dust on the shelves or sitting in boxes at the back of a closet somewhere. Or maybe the books with the best stories in them are sitting in the dark recesses of your own mind. And it's time that you turned the lights back on and that you woke them back up and that you opened them up and let them out to play. Tell a story today. Read a story to someone today. Go on an adventure and make a new story today. Enjoy the day. Be grateful for this day that you have been given. It's the only one that we have. And so thank you. I'll talk to you again real soon, Space Monkeys. Peace.